I spoke in July with Tanner Colby about his latest book, Some of My Best Friends Are Black, The Strange Story of Integration in America. It's published by Viking, and it explores why racial segregation continues to pervade American culture. Despite institutional reforms that have sought to integrate American schools, real estate, and labor markets on the whole, black and white people don't spend much time together. Mr. Colby reflects on why integration doesn't always work, why separate is sometimes equal, and why everyone loves the Cosbys. We got a strong audience response to the conversation, so we are re-airing it for you on this Labor Day holiday. I began by asking Tanner Colby, this seems like an odd book from you. Your previous ones have been about John Belushi and Chris Farley. What did this grow out of?
Well, it grew out of not wanting to write about dead fat comedians anymore. I sort of tapped out the market. I had John Candy left, and then I was going to run out. And people had pretty much pigeonholed me there, saying, you know, well, dead fat comedians, that's what you do. And so I needed to break out of that and wanted to do something else. But I wasn't qualified to do anything else. I was an expert on dead fat comedians. So this was during the 2008 election, and I realized as I was pulling the lever for America's first black president that I didn't really know any black people. And so I thought that was odd. And I started polling all my friends here in New York City. I was like, how many black friends do you have? And they're like, two, one, you know. And so I thought, you know, we've had 40 years of school busing, affirmative action, fair housing, all these programs that were supposed to fix the sins of Jim Crow. And if my middle class, you know, average white kid pipeline has been as lily white as it is, then clearly we did something wrong.
Well, America's race relations can be a taboo subject. Since the book has been published, have you received any flack?
No. In fact, it's been incredibly well received on both sides of the racial aisle. I think because I didn't, you know, I tried not to fall into the classic mistake of taking a partisan lens of a conservative lens or a liberal lens. I just went out and wrote a book about what happened and about – it's not so much a book about race, which tends to get people up in a lather. It's a book about people and how they deal with race.
But judging this is totally anecdotal. When I see kids who've just gotten out of school on the subway or walking down the street, they tend to be totally integrated groups. Are we also talking about generational changes?
There are generational changes, and in terms of – you do see a whole lot of more integration in upper middle class urban areas where things have gotten better in some cases. But it's getting better where it's getting better, and it's getting worse where it's getting worse. If you look at some of the numbers about the increase in minority schools in urban areas. We're definitely not past it.
Well, you grew up going to an integrated school. Were racial issues ever discussed in the classroom?
Well, I grew up in a school that was quite unique in its whiteness, in that it's Vestavia Hills High School. It's a suburb of Birmingham, Alabama, and it was a school that was born in the white flight to escape the desegregation lawsuits in the wake of Birmingham 1963. And our school mascot was Confederate Rebel, and our official school flag was the Confederate flag, which tells you a little bit about what they wanted that school to be when they founded it.
But there were black kids in the school.
We had some black students who came in through busing, who were bused in from a very poor rural area. And we had a handful of black students who were the children of teachers. And we had maybe one or two black students who actually lived inside the city limits. So to call it integrated would be a stretch.
But you often see in the lunchroom where kids can sit together, they often divide themselves by choice according to race.
Yeah. Which is very much came into vogue, weirdly, in the 1990s. There was a book, Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria, which lauded it as an important developmental process rather than the way some people look at it, which is a defense mechanism, that black groups tend to retreat into themselves when feeling in a hostile white environment. But when you look at the reality of high school, if you only cordon yourself off to socialize with black students, and the same with college and black fraternities, then you're missing much of the point of what integration was for, which is not just to get access to a better school, but to integrate socially with the broader population.
A few years back, I started seeing news reports on television about how black people were choosing to move into neighborhoods that were mostly segregated by choice because they felt more comfortable.
Right.
And this almost, it seemed to me, was presented to satisfy white people. You know, see, they don't really want to integrate with us anyway.
Right. Well, that was, I mean, there was a very natural backlash when, you know, after Brown v. Board and the walls of Jim Crow came down, you know, all these laws like school busing and affirmative action sort of shoved white people and black people together in the public square. And white people were, you know, pretty awful. And black people didn't feel respected. They didn't feel that they were wanted or welcome in those spaces. And black America had taken care of itself for hundreds of years. And the age of black power and black nationalism. They said, you know what? We'll do it on our own. And we will go to our own black communities and take care of ourselves. The problem with that being is that separate isn't equal because, frankly, white people have all the money.
Well, but the alternative is that most of the segregated schools were not doing as well with their students, and black kids who were going to integrated schools tended to do better.
Yes.
So, especially if they were in integrated classes.
Yeah, I mean, if you talk to teachers anecdotally, you know, the black kids who sit together in the cafeteria tend to do less well than the black students who are, you know, fully integrated and engaged with the whole community. And that's because, goes back to what Dr. Coleman said in the Coleman report that started racial integration in the first place, which is that the single most important indicator for a child doing well in an all-white environment is the support of their parents. And rather than, you know, helping black parents who wanted to integrate and giving them more socioeconomic leverage to do so, we just sent school buses around the country and just, you know, took, all right, 20% of the black kids are going to go over here and 10% are going to go over there with no regard to whether or not their parents were behind them and supporting them in that. And it was deleterious in a lot of ways.
My guest is Tana Colby. His book, Some of My Best Friends Are Black, The Strange Story of Integration in America. It's published by Viking. You attribute Jesse Clyde Nichols for racializing space. Who was he and how did he do that?
J.C. Nichols was a land developer in Kansas City, Missouri, and he didn't invent racial covenants. They were around in various forms in the early, in the late 1900s and in the early 20th century. But he was just a brilliant, brilliant guy understanding how you could use contracts and land deeds to manipulate what you can do with land in terms of all these suburbs we have today where it's like, okay, the sidewalk must be X feet from the, you know, he sort of pioneered how to do all that. And also in terms of race, because what happened with the Great Migration is that as blacks came into major Midwestern and urban cities, white people got scared. And he saw a remarkable business opportunity. If white people are scared of black people moving into their neighborhoods, then we can sell all white real estate at a premium. And so you had in the South where Jim Crow was the law, he basically privatized it and turned it into a product and made it very, very profitable.
An award-winning play on Broadway right now deals with this, Clyburn Park.
Right.
It begins with whites being pressured not to sell to blacks. And then in the second act, it's about white people who want to move into a black neighborhood.
Right.
As part of the gentrification process.
Mm-hmm.
And black people are concerned that the neighborhood's going to lose its identity.
Right. And that is, in many ways, a legacy of what J.C. Nichols and other real estate developers created, which is that in 1900, there was no such thing as a majority black neighborhood in any major American city. And blacks sorted by class like everyone else. You know, lower income blacks lived in tenements, and middle class blacks moved into more single-family areas where they were welcome, until this idea came along that this is a black neighborhood and that's a white neighborhood. And now both ethnic groups have sort of ingrained that idea that this should be a black neighborhood and this should be a white neighborhood. So when it mixes, you know, if it's blacks moving into a white neighborhood, it's racial takeover, and if it's the other way, it's gentrification.
Although we think of New York as being a relatively integrated city, you can go for miles and miles along Eastern Parkway and not see a white person on the streets.
No, it's a very balkanized city in a lot of ways. There are areas where the lines mix and cross over, like in Fort Greene, but like where I am in Carroll Gardens, we don't have a whole lot of black people in that neighborhood.
One of your chapter headings gave me a bit of a double take. Why do black people drink Hawaiian punch? Mm-hmm. Is that based on statistics?
Well, that's just based on stereotypes. When I was polling, I went back to my high school and I was polling the kids today what questions they have about other black people that they don't understand. And they asked a whole lot of questions that were, basically young, naive, ignorant questions about this race that they don't know. And one of the questions was, why do black people drink Hawaiian punch? Which I thought was funny, because there is a stereotype in the South that, black people drink fruit sodas more often. It's just...
And black people eat watermelon. Well, exactly. So do white people eat watermelon, and I've seen Hawaiian punch.
Exactly.
In a lot of supermarkets in white neighborhoods.
And Dave Chappelle has a whole bit about how black people drink purple drink, and it's a joke that people make, but what the seriousness behind that is that I worked in advertising for 9 years, and advertising shapes what we think and how we see other people. And we have a very racialized advertising industry, both in terms of employment and in terms of the cultural product that's put out there, that we have black agencies and white agencies, and we have, black targeted advertising that really falls way too heavily on stereotypes. The classic example being MC Hammer dancing for Kentucky Fried Chicken in a notorious 1990s commercial that, again, was just repeated by Burger King a couple months ago. And so
with a white and a black,
I was with Mary J. Blige, the R&B singer.
Oh, because there's also been a commercial in which a white and a black, white and black friends are in a car and mm-hmm. they're going to buy some fast food. And
right. It's
caused a big stir.
And it always causes a big stir. And one of the few brands that does it well is one like Nike, where it's not black or white. It's just, it's athletics, it's sport, and everybody loves it, and it's well done. But you rarely see that.
But this doesn't apply to everything. For example, in the music industry, which used to be mm-hmm. a lot more segregated, now I think kids just buy records. White kids buy rap records.
But the music industry, it was always segregated on the surface. But if you read the history of it in terms of, white kids sneaking into jazz clubs in the 1920s, and, it's always been... blacks and whites weren't allowed to play in the same clubs under Jim Crow, but after hours, black and white musicians would get together and jam. So that was always a very integrated and give and take cultural institution, because people do that for the love of it. Advertising is about the money. And when it comes down to who gets the money, it's not nearly as friendly.
What are some of the other examples of integration working? I mean, other than the Cosby right. Show's incredible popularity.
Integration works where people choose to make it work. I profiled a neighborhood in Kansas City where there's been a very conscientious effort to protect everyone's property rights and have a racially mixed environment. And even within that community that's very conscious of trying to be this type of thing, similar to Shaker Heights, Ohio, or Mount Airy, Pennsylvania, within those neighborhoods you find black and white antagonism. You find some people who choose to integrate and some people who don't. So in terms of things that are integrated, I don't really think in terms of, is the TV industry integrated because it has X number of black writers. It's more of a qualitative measure of, individuals.
Well, we have seen this in polling about the upcoming election mm-hmm. where many whites complain that blacks will vote in large numbers for Barack Obama simply because he's black. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, there are a lot of white voters who might normally vote for a Democrat who right. won't simply because Barack Obama is black.
Right. Well, the main problem with so many blacks voting for the Democratic Party, independent of Obama, is that the Republicans have just left them nowhere to go, given the policies that the Republicans have pursued for so many years.
A listener wants to know about racial discrimination in residential zoning. There was a provision in Levittown that said blacks couldn't buy homes. Do we see that today? Isn't it against the law?
They are against the law, and technically, if you go into a lot of the higher-end neighborhoods, like the ones that J.C. Nichols pioneered in Kansas City and the ones that were copycatted off of that in Dallas and in other places, the racial covenants are still there. They're not enforceable and they're illegal, but they haven't been stripped out.
They just become a part
right.
of the culture.
And it's not so much it's still technically illegal to redline and to discriminate in housing, but you still get a lot of steering. And you get a lot of real estate agents who will just nudge black residents this way and nudge white residents that way. And that compounds upon the fact that people naturally gravitate to their own communities.
There's a class, an elementary school class picture on the cover of your book. Mm-hmm. Has one black kid in the class. Is this from your school?
That's me. Yeah, that's my 3-year-old preschool class in Lafayette, Louisiana. I'm the snotty, messed up kid sitting all the way to the bottom of the left with the sandals and the striped T-shirt. And then it's funny because I was explaining that photograph to a friend of mine, and I said all the white kids look messy, and then she said, "Let me guess, the black kid's wearing a suit," and she hadn't even seen the picture.
Tana Colby's book, Some of My Best Friends Are Black, The Strange Story of Integration in America, is published by Viking. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you very much.